Hey, my name is Ron Roger. I'm an actor from such shows as Matlock, Stranger Things, Power Rangers, and maybe a few more. You are listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles.
Welcome to Rising Up with Sona Ali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. On this show, you'll hear solutions, journalism for social justice, fueling action, not despair. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer. This week, we'll do a post-mortem on Zohran Mamdani's campaign for New York City mayor and how its lessons can apply more broadly. My guest will be Yashika Dutt, a Brooklyn-based journalist who's covered the high-profile mayoral candidacy since April. Then we'll go to Belém, Brazil, where the COP30 climate meeting is taking place. My guest, Osprey Auriel Lake, executive director of the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, will discuss how a comprehensive legal framework called the Rights of Nature can help stave off climate change. Finally, Gabriela Oliveira, a professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, will share stories from her new book, Now We Are Here, Family Migration, Children's Education, and Dreams for a Better Life. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. Zohran Mamdani, the unlikely 34-year-old Uganda-born South Asian Muslim immigrant, is New York City's new mayor. Journalist Yashika Dutt, who has closely followed his campaign, described last Tuesday's election this way, quote, "Against all odds, Mamdani, through his gifted political acumen, a brilliant team of 30-something managers, and his exceptional hold over his own narrative and messaging, carved his own space in the political mainstream while the establishment was intent on not giving him an inch," end of quote. So how did he do it? Were there missed opportunities? What are lessons that we can learn from his campaign and candidacy? Yashika Dutt joins me. She's a Dalit journalist and author of the award-winning book On Caste, Coming Out as Dalit. She's been covering New York's mayoral election since April and was the first journalist to extensively cover the South Asian mobilization for the Mamdani campaign. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Sonali. It's a pleasure to be here.
So was it surprising for you? I mean, polls showed that he looked like he was going to win. It would have been shocking if he hadn't, it seems. And still, it felt, at least for those of us watching from far off, quite unreal. What was that like on election night? What was the atmosphere in the city?
The atmosphere in the city, not just on election night, but in the weeks before the election, was absolutely electric. I have been reporting, like you mentioned, since April, and there was such a stark difference in what we saw during the primary. Even before the primary election in New York, there was a sense that Mamdani could win. Somebody who had been attending all these events and seeing the response from people change towards him in such a dramatic way. I remember I attended the this event in Ozone Park, which is a Bangladeshi majority neighborhood here in Queens, in New York City. And he literally got mobbed by Desi folks, a lot of people who wanted to get photos clicked with him. People saw on their Instagram stories that he was there and they just rushed to see him, to get a glimpse of him. And that was before the primary. So you can imagine after months of excitement and the polls that were really showed him way ahead of Andrew Cuomo, and also the events that he had done. I mean, it wasn't just social media. A lot of people in the establishment, the Democratic establishment, have tried to characterize the campaign. Even Andrew Cuomo himself said that it was a social media campaign. Witnessing it from on ground, there was so much more. One of the things that for me stood out was that in his campaign, there was this incredible love for New York. As an immigrant myself, this is something I associate with. We leave our entire lives and move to the city. And I think nobody loves New York more than immigrants, people who willfully make a home here. And you could see that through the events, whether that was the scavenger hunt that he organized in the summer, which was around these specific New York City landmarks that had a connection to City Hall, or there was the football tournament that he organized in Coney Island on Diwali Day, which is a prominent Hindu festival, which is also celebrated in the Sikh community. He distributed sweets out of a Jackson Heights store. So there were no areas in New York that he hadn't covered. And the campaign really worked hard to make sure that areas and boroughs where he hadn't performed that well in the primary were now aware of Mamdani's presence. And I think that specifically stood out. Being in New York on election night, a lot of people said it felt like pre-COVID energy had come back to the city because, you know, since 2020, the city has been lurching towards, you know, trying to attain a sense of normalcy that we had before. And the Mamdani campaign, whether it with his visits to the nightclubs in Bushwick and Williamsburg on the Friday before the election, everybody who was out there on Halloween weekend just truly lost their minds seeing him there. And many people said, why are you here? We all are going to vote for you, because those areas were where he was extremely popular as it is. So it was just wonderful to witness that. And for a lot of New Yorkers, it was an opportunity to reclaim their relationship with New York, because New York has become so prohibitively expensive over the past several years, especially since COVID, that a lot of people have been forced to leave the city, especially working class folks, middle class folks who can't afford to stay here. And for people who are here, who are struggling, who have felt like, you know, it's so hard to still survive, a lot of us fell back in love with our city, which was, I think, for me, one of the most special aspects of this campaign.
He didn't just lean into his identity. He leaned into the economic justice policies. And this may be reducing it a little bit, but do you feel that that double-pronged theme of his campaign, so centrally, you know, was so central, his South Asian identity, his Muslim identity, the fact that he identified as a democratic socialist, the fact that he was from Uganda, born in Uganda, his identity, all of the myriad intersectional complex identities, he didn't try to downplay them. He leaned into them and lifted them up at the same time as he was constantly talking about rent stabilization, fast and free buses, universal childcare. I mean, I live in LA and I can recite his agenda off the top of my head. How critical was that double strategy?
I think the strategy for the Mamdani campaign has been very crucially about message discipline. There are so many aspects around Zohran Mamdani. He's not only Muslim, he's South Asian. He's a DSA member, which is in itself was a controversial aspect when his primary campaign launched, and he has been attacked about it. The fact that he had been critical of the NYPD in the past. So there were so many aspects of his campaign where there were potential vulnerabilities where he could have been attacked. But the fact that stood him in a good space was that he kept coming back to affordability. I have attended several events where Zoran Mamdani was asked difficult questions. For example, when he had spoken about Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his involvement in the Gujarat riots in 2002, and in the course of the
Modi's involvement in the riots, right?
Mm-hmm. Modi's, absolutely. I mean, had to clarify that. Prime Minister Modi's involvement. Zoran Mamdani had made comments around that, being extremely critical of PM Modi, in a mayoral forum back in, I think, May or June. And obviously, over the course of the campaign, a lot of Hindu New Yorkers who are Prime Minister Modi's supporters did not appreciate that and really pushed back on that and, in fact, called him Hindu-phobic. And in response to that, Zoran Mamdani did an incredibly smart thing. The campaign visited 6 or 7 temples in New York City, a lot of Hindu temples. And there he was asked a lot of difficult questions. He was asked about his previous comments, whether he wanted to apologize for them, whether he was quote unquote anti-Hindu because, you know, he sort of foregrounds his Muslim identity, despite the fact that he is half Hindu. So during all of those conversations, I saw him repeatedly come back to the message of affordability. I saw him repeatedly, you know, address the issue at hand and then link it back to how his campaign is going to work for working class New Yorkers. And I think that's the message that really appeals to people, because this was a stark fact in the city that the Democratic establishment was seemingly not paying attention to. Over the, like I've mentioned in my previous answer, the inflation in New York has really become so prohibitively high that even people, there's a story that was published in the New York Times a couple of days ago, that even people who earn $150,000 are feeling the pinch, and they voted for Mamdani. So when he addressed these issues that affect working class New Yorkers, when he talked about how everybody has the right to dream, it's not just something that rich New Yorkers can afford. Everybody, whether you're middle class, whether you're working class, should be able to afford to live here and should have the comfort of a good life. And I think those messages really stood out to people, whether he, you know, treated every New Yorker as somebody who deserved to be here, whether they were homeless or unhoused, or if they lived in public housing, which has been, you know, the New Yorkers who live in public housing have sort of been ignored by previous administrations. So he directly addressed them. And it made people feel that here is a candidate who at least is willing to fight for us, who seems authentic, who seems genuine. And I think that really stood out for people.
Finally, Yashika, what are the things that you foresee as a journalist who has covered the campaign, but also a progressive journalist? What are the takeaways that you think people looking to replicate Mamdani's success might want to pay attention to? Of course, tailor-made to their own identity, to their own constituency. But, you know, people outside New York City have very jealously watched what has played out, wondering how they can get their own democratic socialist, charismatic, disciplined candidate.
I think one of the things that people have seen and adapted already are the social media strategies, which, I mean, in itself is pretty groundbreaking, but not novel. We saw that with the AOC, Congresswoman AOC's campaign, the way she does lives, and she goes live on Instagram, speaks to her voter base, she answers questions, she makes sure that she is bringing voters and people into the Congress, showing them how things are done there. We have here in New York, Councilmember Chi Ose, who's from Bed-Stuy, who has a very strong social media game as well. And it's not just social media. That's what Andrew Cuomo's campaign tried to replicate. And they said, oh, he won because of TikTok, and I can do that as well. And they tried it. Eric Adams tried it. But the reason that didn't work is because they didn't have, first of all, like I mentioned, the message discipline, but also the policies. I think what Zoran Mamdani campaign did really well is that they understood what New Yorkers were feeling. One of the aspects of the candidate Zoran Mamdani and his campaign that have emerged very prominently is that they listen. more than speaking, whether it is in a room full of business leaders. He met with Bloomberg as well, former Mayor Bloomberg, and he met with business leaders. He's met, obviously, been with working class communities. One of the things that have emerged over and over is that people say that he is really good at listening to people. So he heard how people were feeling. He understood, the campaign understood what was lacking in the city, and they molded their policies based on what was going on here. Another thing I want to mention,
there was an authenticity to him that people instantly got, because voters are savvy. More than ever now, they are savvy. We live in an era of, you know, staged videos and people are developing a sense for how to tell somebody who is like, you know, Gavin Newsom, who's just basically trying to say what he thinks will get him elected. And they can tell the difference between that and Mamdani, who just genuinely seems to embody what he believes.
I also feel that one of the more overlooked aspects is, of course, there were 100,000 canvassers who really spent their time and energy and weekends and, you know, evenings after work, having a long day of work, and then they're going out there and being in community with other Zohran Mamdani supporters. But also there was this mobilization of organizers, which is, you know, New York is a union town. New York has a very long and solid, strong history of community organizers. And he tapped into that energy and used that because he has been a community organizer himself. He worked with Chaya CDC, which is a housing justice organization focused on South Asian New Yorkers, and he worked as a community organizer there. So he understood how to harness that power. So if there are folks out there watching who want to replicate this in their cities, as a journalist, my observations will be to really authentically convey the issues that are localized to you and to tap into community organizing, because nothing makes a bigger difference than somebody who's one of your peers, one of your neighbors, somebody you go to school with, telling you why you should vote for this candidate and how that can make a difference for you.
And also, I want to mention that there's already a new organization called Our Time that is formed from people who volunteered and canvassed for the Mamdani campaign as a way for, you know, that 100,000 group to pour their energy into, so that it's not just from one election to the other, but all of the important work that needs to happen between elections. Because, of course, Mamdani is going to need a lot of participation and buy-in to ensure his agenda gets enacted, right? That, I feel like that's also a really important post-election aspect that is of note.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's why the effort from the get has been to be transparent. They announced a transition team with Lina Khan as one of the main members, the key members. They just announced the deputy mayors yesterday. And with that effort, there is, you know, the sense of accountability to the public. One of the key asks that Zohran Mamdani's campaign made the day after they were elected was to ask for donations. And a lot of people got very offended and upset by that ask, because they wondered, why do you need donations now? And the fact is that you can't use the money that you raised for an election campaign to fund the transition team. And usually other administrations are funded by lobbyists, they are funded by donors who are private donors who have vested interests. And what the Mamdani campaign is doing is they're bypassing those channels and going to the public and letting them know that we are accountable to you, and that's why you should fund our transition so we can stay accountable to you. And in terms of, you know, when he takes on, becomes the mayor in January, I think the groups that he mobilized, 100,000 canvassers, the political energy that is there in the city, are really going to be key in putting pressure on other elected officials to make sure that his agendas are passed. Like, for example, Governor Kathy Hochul, who has been extremely resistant to his policies about, you know, taxing the richest New Yorkers. And every time that she has met with his supporters, for example, she was at the Forest Hills rally in Queens a couple of weeks before the election, and chants of tax the rich nearly drowned out her speech. Mamdani had to come and get her off the stage. And when she was at Somos in Puerto Rico last week or early this week, again, tax the rich chants were everywhere. So people are not only feeling powerful, but they're also feeling mobilized. They're feeling like they can hold other officials to account. So many officials in New York City are pretty terrified of being primaried by DSA elected officials because people have recognized the power that they hold right now.
Yashika, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I'll post a link to your story in New Lines magazine and all of the stories that you've written from our website, risingupwithsonali.com. Thank you so much and good luck to you.
Thank you so much for having me, Sonali. It's a pleasure.
My guest has been Yashika Dutt, Dalit journalist and author of the award-winning book on caste, Coming Out as Dalit. She's been covering New York's mayoral election since April. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. The latest United Nations Climate Conference, COP30, is taking place in Belém, Brazil, where nations are still attempting after decades to comprehensively tackle climate change and its impacts head-on. While much mainstream American discourse on climate justice is centered on preserving humanity and human lives, a new brief by the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, or WECAN International, brings to the forefront a critically important tool for climate justice, the rights of nature, an all-encompassing legal approach to preserving all life. My guest is Osprey Oria-Lake, founder and executive director of WECAN. She sits on the executive committee for the Global Alliance for the Rights of Nature and is joining me now from COP30. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. Good to see you.
The place that I've heard the rights of nature really come up, and I think folks who are engaged in the climate justice movement know of Ecuador's case in 2008, I believe it was, that Ecuador essentially changed its constitution to encompass, to uphold and to preserve the rights of nature. Using that, using Ecuador as an example, how do you explain what it means when you say the rights of nature?
Well, it's really an important country where rights of nature, as you said, put in 2008, rights of nature into the Constitution. And it's been a growing movement for many years. In the 70s, there was a professor, Christopher Stone, who put out a document called If Trees Had Standing, which in essence basically said, could we have a form of jurisprudence, a way of law that recognized that the natural world could have its own rights. And it's a really important activity, philosophy, and action for the climate justice movement, because right now, nature does not have standing in a court of law. And so in the new systems that we have since colonialism, people own property. And so you have to have the property owner represent a river or a mountain or a forest. And what rights of nature laws do is they really turn this inside out and upside down and say, no, we actually are living in a time in which the rivers and the mountains and all of the animals need their own rights to be represented and have their own voice in court of law. And so what's very exciting is that this was put into the Constitution in Ecuador in 2008. And right now, what's been really exciting is that the movement has grown quite exponentially since then, and there are about 39 countries now who are having different exchanges around rights of nature or have rights of nature laws or in the process of bringing them into local national arenas. And so it's pretty exciting to see how this has grown. And I think there's a real appetite for it because we're seeing that a lot of environmental regulations are not working. And just shortly on that, you know, even the term environmental regulation, what we're seeing because of corporatocracy and the ways that government and corporations are in bed with each other, that what we see are systems of regulations against harms and pollution and toxicity, but not actually stopping the harm. And what rights of nature laws do is they say the river has the right to flow and thrive and be healthy in its own inherent integrity. And so it's a really powerful protection for nature. And we're here at COP30 to really bring this argument of rights of nature into the negotiations.
How much of this framework is an outgrowth of the work of Indigenous communities who have long seen the balance between nature and humanity as completely as being, you know, something that is very important, and that the fate of human beings and nature is deeply intertwined?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. And in fact, in our report, it's one of the recognitions that we start the report with, is that a lot of these ideas about rights of nature are really in some ways translating ancient Indigenous knowledge about living in reciprocity with the land, living in respect to nature, living in harmony with the natural world. And so the question was asked really of Indigenous peoples throughout this movement, how do we actually translate that inherent understanding of our relationship with the natural world that has health and justice at the center into modern concepts of law? And so, yes, it's really important that we recognize that a lot of this philosophy and worldview comes from traditional knowledge of Indigenous peoples. And one of the things that's been really exciting about being here at COP30 is that we've been actually organizing a lot with Indigenous partners here who are leading this movement. And as you mentioned, I'm on the executive committee of the Global Alliance for Rights of Nature. And several years ago, we initiated something called the Indigenous Council, so that the Indigenous Council could really lead this worldview and philosophy that is the underpinning of the rights of nature movement, because it's not just a legal concept, it's a cultural transformation. It's basically saying how we're living with the earth is not working, and we need to understand how to change our economy. How do we change our work? How do we live with one another differently? It also addresses issues of racism and colonialism about how do we respect the earth and all of us living together in a healthy manner. And so this leadership of Indigenous peoples is really important to the entire movement.
What would it do to specifically further climate justice and reverse climate change? Draw the line between your wildest dreams being fulfilled with COP30 adopting this. Say it were to happen, how could that framework then become the way in which the globe tackles climate change?
Well, to get really specific, and here I'm at COP, so of course that's what's on my mind. In the formal UNFCCC COP30 process, at COP26, there was the initiation of something called the Just Transition Work Program. And there are many different parts of the Paris Climate Agreement continuing to be negotiated. And that's one piece of it, the Just Transition Work Program. And so one of the reasons that we wrote the report that you mentioned is we're bringing that to negotiators. We're bringing that to countries to have them think through how rights of nature is central to the just transition, so that we can have a practical application and a way to advocate globally, as you were mentioning, for rights of nature. And I think the Just Transition Work Program is one of the most expansive opportunities in the negotiations, and there's not that many, where we have the opportunity to really intervene with a climate justice framework, intervene with our ideas about what a just transition is, and not have that idea be co-opted. And so I think this is our global opportunity to really visibilize how rights of nature fundamentally changes, as I've been mentioning, our economy. Because as an example, if, in fact, a river has rights or a forest has rights, that means companies cannot go to that forest or to that river and pollute, because it would be damaging the rights of that river or forest to live and thrive in a healthy manner for itself. And so it's a fundamental shift in putting the earth at the center of the conversation. And right now, I've been to many, many COPs. Mother Earth, nature, the web of life, is not the center of the negotiations. What we see at the center of the negotiations is finance and how people are going to profit off of pollution and how we're going to continue business as usual. And people and planet are not at the center of the negotiations. And I think Rights of Nature is really revolutionary because it does just that. It says nature has rights, communities has rights, land defenders have rights. And that's what we should be talking about.
What will it take to get this framework adopted more broadly? You said there's been tremendous activity since Ecuador, and of course, you know, since Ecuador adopted the Rights of Nature, and that happened after decades of work, years of work by people. We're running out of time. The planet is the species. Our many species are running out of time. Certainly, human beings as a whole are running out of time. What would it take to get a global framework adopted, and who is standing in the way? I think I can predict your answer, that it's the usual suspects, the usual culprits.
Yeah, I think you probably could. I think in terms of obstacles, let's just look at one factor here. At COP30, you know, we've been analyzing with other groups how many fossil fuel lobbyists. We do know that research has shown over 5,000 fossil fuel lobbyists have attended the COPs between COP26 and COP29. So when running through the hallways where we're trying to end the era of fossil fuels and transition to renewables, we have all these lobbyists who are trying to continue the era of fossil fuels. So of course, Rights of Nature is not in their agenda. But on the other side, I would also just cite that, as I said, 39 countries are now engaged in Rights of Nature laws, and it is a growing movement. And we've seen cases in Colombia to protect the Amazon River be successful. In Ecuador, rivers have been protected using Rights of Nature laws. We've seen them across the United States in different communities that have stopped harms to communities from different extractive industries. In Spain, there was a huge victory earlier a few years ago on a river being protected. So it's already being implemented country by country. Now we're looking at an initiative, and actually, if you go to our website, we drafted an initial initiative around how we could go about getting countries to begin a mechanism to create a global movement towards Rights of Nature, where all countries would negotiate. What would that look like? So we've begun to map out how we could have a framework and an initiative to sit down and have a negotiation around Rights of Nature. It's something I'm very interested in. So I really love that you brought that up, because it's a particular passion of mine. And as I said, we've already written a beginning framework for that, which is on our website. And the last thing I'll say on that, I think it's really inspiring that the Inter-American Court for Human Rights put out a ruling earlier this year that explicitly actually mentioned Rights of Nature as essential for governance if we're going to live in a healthy manner with the earth. So it is picking up international attention, and I think that helps us move in the right direction. But, you know, let's not kid ourselves. We have a huge battle ahead. Some countries are saying that climate change is a hoax. I could go on and on. And so the challenge is quite big, but I think that the movement is growing because people are looking for frameworks that actually do serve people and planet, and Rights of Nature is a big enough tent for us to be able to bring in frontline communities, to bring in Indigenous peoples, to bring in Black and Brown communities, to bring in nature, and be able to have a framework in which all our voices are represented. And I think that's one thing that's really missing, especially when we see the global elite, the global wealthy elite beginning to consolidate their power more and more. We're seeing the rise of authoritarian governments. We need a vision that's big enough that really houses our vision of a way forward, which is why in this report, we really were matching up the Just Transition Framework and Rights of Nature, because we think these are the two strongest movements that really are coming from our communities and putting forward a climate justice framework that's really comprehensive.
Finally, Osprey, one of the things that jumped out at me in the brief that your organization, We Can, put out on Rights of Nature, and I should emphasize that you're the executive director of the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network. One of the things that jumped out was that the Rights of Nature, the report says, subverts patriarchal worldviews. And I'd like for you to expand on that. How can we think of such a framework as even expanding the rights of women?
Yes, I think it's really important to understand that, you know, we're talking about the rights of nature. we are nature. Humans are nature. And so when we're talking about the rights for nature, we're also talking about indigenous rights, women's rights. But very specifically, one of the things that we have to look at historically is that the violence against women and the violence against the earth are very intertwined. And when we think about the long history of patriarchy and this model of extraction, this model of supremacy, this model of men above women and one gender is more important than the others, or how humans should have dominion over nature, or people of one color have dominion over another. This whole idea of supremacy and domination is inherently driving us on a death march right now into the extractive economy, into capitalism, into systems of imperialism. And so for us, this analysis of understanding feminist economics, and I'll just point out one example we gave in the report of a care economy that really acknowledges the care work that women do, that gets underpaid and under acknowledged, is part of the economy that Rights of Nature is pushing forward, because it recognizes all those unseen places, all the work that is not counted in our current colonial and capitalistic systems. And so when we're looking at Rights of Nature, we're looking at a whole systems approach about how we honor each community, how we respect the rights of people, which are part of nature. And so for us, the analysis also included this dismantling and transformation of the patriarchy, which is inherently been detrimental to women, to people of color, to indigenous people, and to the land. And part of this dismantling that Rights of Nature does immediately when those laws are put into place is also part of the transformation of the society that we do want, of equity and well-being and living in harmony with nature.
I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Osprey. Give out a website where people can get a hold of the report themselves.
Sure. It is WECAN, WECAN, and the word international spelled out, .org. So WECANinternational.org. And then you go to the section that has reports. And that report there, the policy brief is there, and many others. And people are welcome to have a look at that and be in a conversation. We wrote the report to be in conversation as we're collectively working on systems change.
And we'll post a link to that from our website. Thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck at COP30.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest has been Osprey Auriel Lake, founder and executive director of the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network International, and she sits on the executive committee for the Global Alliance for the Rights of Nature. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. Donald Trump's second term agenda is centered on the criminalization, scapegoating, incarceration, and disappearance of non-white immigrants. And although many Americans seem to have forgotten it, his first term was also marked by the same. A new book called Now We Are Here follows the stories of 16 migrant families from Latin America who were victims of harsh government enforcement through 2018 and 2019, and how their stories distill the deeply politicized issue of immigration through a much-needed human lens. The author, Gabrielle Oliveira, now joins me. She is the Jorge Paulo Lehmann Associate Professor of Education and Brazil Studies at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. And the full title of her book is Now We Are Here, Family Migration, Children's Education, and Dreams for a Better Life. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me, Sonali. I really appreciate it.
So as I mentioned, a lot of folks forgot the family separation scandal, the horrific kind of human tragedy that unfolded in the years 2016 to 2020, and far too many Americans decided that they could cast their vote for Trump, including people from mixed status families, mixed status immigrant families. And now we're seeing, I think, an escalation even, it seems, of what happened in the first term. So tell me about these families you profiled and why you wrote this book. These are families that were victimized, criminalized, and really traumatized 2018 and 2019. Why them?
Right. So I was doing work, you know, at the time I was doing work in schools here in Massachusetts that had bilingual programs, which meant that, you know, children were learning in Portuguese and in Spanish. And that has been, you know, some of the work that I've been doing for my own trajectory, my own career. And I started hearing, doing these interviews with families, families describing what had happened to them at the border, either being detained and separated or detained together. And those stories just seem that, you know, the families were very much still thinking about those stories. The children were bringing those stories to the schools, and the teachers didn't really know what to do with, you know, the stories that were being brought to the schools. So for me, it was really important to try to capture in real time what was happening and to hear from the families that had just gone through those separations and detentions, either together, right, or being sent to different places in the United States. So I started interviewing these folks, you know, weeks sometimes after they had been reunified. So it was very fresh in their minds, but I continued interviewing them and observing these families for 3 years. So that separation and that policy had such an impact on how they understood, you know, their roles as parents and how they cared for their children, that for me was very important to capture that in the long term.
You focus on children's education and how that is such a driver for families that emigrate here. And none of this is surprising, right? It's almost like the sort of age-old people coming looking for the American dream. And frankly, it's not just the American dream. A lot of migration is based on that, even in other parts of the world. But tell us what you learned with some specifics in terms of how the needs and aspirations, the needs of children and the aspirations of their parents is a common theme.
Absolutely. So one of the things that we hear a lot in immigration, how the media covers immigration, right, or some of the immigration research, is this kind of idea that, you know, the push and pull framework, which means people are leaving their countries because of lack of opportunities, poverty, violence, corruption, and they're going to another country that has pulling factors, right? So more opportunities, better education systems, better health systems, all of that that they're going to. So a lot of these parents and children become reduced to this one dimension narrative, right? That you're escaping for survival, which they were. They absolutely were. But what was really interesting to me was to hear how education is not only part of the American dream of who they want to be and the kind of social mobility that they're expecting. But it's also this counter narrative to all the trauma and, you know, the hardships that they experienced until they got to the United States. So education sits in this place of hope, right? And when I talk about education, I don't mean just the academic achievement, which is kind of this classic idea of, I hope, you know, immigrant children are doing really well in schools and they're, you know, even being better than sometimes their peers who are U.S. born. But it's also education in the sense of you becoming a good person who's polite, who's respectful, who's a caring human being, right? So it's all those desires that parents have for their children that it doesn't just mean academic achievement. Now,
so just having an environment where children can thrive is part of it.
Exactly. An environment where children can thrive and they can be safe, right? So parents describe this idea of having seeing their children going into the school building and as this very safe moment, right, of realization of saying this is working, my sacrifice was worth it, right? Going into these classrooms where there are books, there's, you know, teachers, there's resources, there's food, there's a cafeteria, there's physical education, art, right? All these things that they were so hopeful that their children would get that go way beyond just kind of the result on a test.
And I'm also wondering if you can share what the push factors, to use some of that reductive terminology, has been. These are all families from Latin America. Mm-hmm. I see that many of the folks that you profiled are from Central America, which is where mm-hmm. we've seen so much migration coming from. But these are also, of course, countries that have experienced deep instability, a lot of violence. What were these families escaping? And in your conversations with them, what did they expect to find when they arrived at the U.S. border?
Absolutely. So the number one way that these families were describing what's pushing them out is really this lack of safety, right, in their homes. And that means that the government, there's descriptions of governments being corrupt, right, that you not knowing who you can trust, that different parallel governments working in these small towns kind of collecting money to ensure safety. But if you have a misstep or something happens, you know, you may, you know, they may come after you. And many families reported, you know, parents reported that the husbands in the families suffered, you know, attacks, violent attacks, that they were beaten in front of their children, right, because they owe money to a particular group, for example. They also reported that their children were harassed on the way to school, especially the girls and the young women. So all of that brings together this kind of space of not feeling safe and a deep unhopefulness for the future, right? This lack of hope that things could get better. So I put this into the context of also in history of trying to think that the U.S. has also a huge piece of contribution there, right? Thinking about during the Cold War and all the interventions in Central and South America, destabilizing these countries who have never been able to really recover from them and have been stuck in the cycle, right, of this deep corruption with lack of opportunities, high unemployment, high urban violence, right? All of that, lack of investment in education. So all of that is a recipe for parents to say, I don't think this is a good place for my children to grow. Many families were actually running away to survive, right? They were running away for their lives because of the multiple threats and the violence that they had suffered. Other families were trying to get out in time so that they wouldn't get to that place. But these were all families who were running for their lives.
Did folks who experienced the harsh cruelty at the American border experience regret? Were they wondering, oh goodness, what have we done?
The parents definitely engaged with that question in all my interviews. They engaged with that very painful question. I never asked that question because I never thought it was a question that I could ask in that way because of what it meant, right, for their own mental health. To feel stable as a worthy caregiver, which they all are, because I also write this, that to migrate is to care, right? It is the way that they're caring for their children. But they did think about this idea of, was the sacrifice worth it? And especially because for the families who were detained and separated, specifically for the ones who were separated, they didn't know how long they'd be separated from their children for, right? They didn't know if it was 5 days or the most that in a family in my work was 72 days, right? So while you're going through that, you're regretting everything. You're regretting leaving. You're regretting going through everything that you did because you're away from your children. But I was able to interview them when they had been reunified. So in many ways, the story had a more hopeful tone because they were together and they were thinking about, you know, the title of the book, Now We're Here, What Can We Do About Our Future? So I think there's these two pieces of while they were in there, separated, detained, all those feelings of guilt and was it worth it were very much apparent. And then they slightly dissipate as they become reunified.
What is the lasting effect of the trauma of separation been like? You mentioned that you interviewed these families, not just after they were reunited, but followed them for a while. And the kinds of experiences that we read about, just even a child being separated from their mother or father, the impact on both sides, on the parents and on the children, I imagine that has lasting effect.
Absolutely. The lasting effect, you know, there's a lot of work that has been done on documenting the trauma, and trauma gets enacted in different ways, right? You can see children and youth who may become not as engaged in school. They may act out. They may not pay attention. They may develop deep anxiety and depression, right, because of that. And without the support, without a therapist, without a social worker, without parents getting help as well, it's very hard to support children, right, like that. But you also have the other children and youth who actually do the opposite. They become very much involved and they go all in their education as a way to forget and to push away, right, those memories. So you kind of see those things happening. And the main issue is really an entire generation growing up, right, with that trauma that has not been dealt with properly in their lives, and just seeing them try to figure out friendships, trying to trust people, trying to, you know, graduate and find jobs. And they still think about it and they still talk about it, right? So while I finished this research in 2021, I'm still in touch with all the families. And it always comes up one way or another, especially now with what we're seeing in the country, triggers them to think about what had happened before. And now I find it important to say that this is not a deterministic piece, right? It's not saying because that happened to you, that's going to be forever with you. But in many ways, schools and districts really struggle to support and to help that type of therapy, right, that children need, that is specifically about immigration trauma.
The 16 families you profiled, where are they now? Are they all in the United States? Did some of them return, or were they sent back? Have their statuses been adjusted? What is the future secure for them, or are they still living in fear given Trump's second term?
No one has gone back. From the core families I worked with, nobody was deported, but they all have somebody in that extended family that has been, something has happened, a cousin, an uncle, a friend, somebody in their surroundings that something happened, but nobody has gone back and no status has been adjusted, but they still have their court dates to show up and to see if that's going to happen. But they're very nervous about going to court. They're nervous about what could happen when they go because of the circulating news, the videos. You know, they have these WhatsApp groups where people share videos daily about things that are happening, and the fear level really goes up.
So, right, because ICE agents are going into courts, immigration court hearings, and snatching people up who are in the process of actually following the stated requirements for them. So it is, I can imagine, quite nerve-wracking and probably
and in,
very
and
triggering.
In front of children and in front of the children. So the children are again put into this position of having to be in the, you know, around the adults. So something may happen to the adults. And then our biggest worry right now is this, you know, third iteration of family separation, which would be if a parent is removed, then a child stays here on their own. What are they supposed to do? So that fear follows a lot of these families, but the children are doing really well in school and are, you know, they're playing Little League baseball, they're dancing, they're going to parties, they're going to the park. Like, they're trying to live their normal lives, but with that fear that just surrounds the future. So no, the future is not safe and secure for them, not at this time. My fear is that solely putting the emphasis on kind of their productivity may take us away from kind of the North Star of children's well-being, right? Because in many ways, I write this in the book, I think children are deserving to be ordinary. Not everybody needs to be like the best at this or the best at that, but they just deserve to be worthy, for us to think about children as all being worthy of having a good life, right? A life of dignity, as one of the youth asking that. But I think what we're going to see, not right now, but I think we're going to see in the next few years, just how much what's happening this year is actually really breaking the foundations of this country apart in terms of the industries that all these folks work in.
And then finally, Gabriel, how do you respond to those people who continue to defend Trump's harsh immigration policies? I mean, you see so much online trolling and this kind of callous sense of, when faced with horrific injustices where people are tackled by ICE agents and disappeared, family separated, US citizens sobbing because their immigrant spouse was taken from them, that the response becomes, well, they shouldn't be here because they were illegal, get over it, deport them all. Which of course doesn't apply to white South Africans or Melania Trump. What can you say to those folks that we have to believe have a shred of humanity somewhere inside them?
I know, and I feel I, if you asked me this 2 years ago, maybe I would have had a different response. And now I think a lot about, bringing people together from the different sides of the political spectrum, or partisan spectrum, to kind of think about what would happen if we make policy that honors children's well-being, right? What would happen if we think about that 5-year-old that is now going to have to live without one of the parents, right? What happens to that? So I think it'd be much more productive and better for our society if we think about that piece versus this kind of removal, right, that we're seeing in that way. And, a lot of these families are asylum seekers. They came, the families in my work are asylum seekers. They came, they surrendered themselves at the border. They talked about their case. They're waiting to go see a judge and argue in front of a judge. And this is US law. This is how the US has always been. So if we're changing all of that in a way that doesn't feel like we're doing due process, I also wonder when is it going to come to all of us, right? So I also think that for US citizens who may feel strongly one way or another, if you're running an operation that is so unchecked, nothing is going to prevent it from actually getting to you, your loved ones, and the people around you. Now, that's not my argument. My personal argument is one for, thinking about human beings as equal, right? As deserving, and as not deciding just because you were born here or there, you have more or less rights. Absolutely not. I also understand that each country has their own rules of sovereignty and get to decide who comes in. I absolutely understand that. But we have 1 in 4 children in the United States are sons and daughters of immigrants. They're in every school, all over the place. So what is the plan? Is the plan a haphazard one, right, that could cause more trauma? Or is it one that we're actually thinking about making sure that these children feel belonging and then they feel like they're here and they belong and they can work hard to build an even better society? I think that this is a better way of looking at it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Gabrielle. Best of luck to you. We'll post a link to your book from our website. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate all that you do talking about these really tough and important topics. So thank you for all your work.
Thank you. My guest has been Gabriela Oliveira, the Jorge Paulo Lehmann Associate Professor of Education and Brazil Studies at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. We've been talking about her new book, Now We Are Here: Family Migration, Children's Education, and Dreams for a Better Life. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms.
KPFK is hosting a meet and greet for listeners and supporters from Ventura, Oxnard, Carpinteria, and Santa Barbara on Saturday, November 15th from 11 till 4 p.m. at the First Congregational Church located in Santa Barbara. The entrance is on the corner of State Street and West Padre Street. This event includes a potluck for which all are invited to participate as we want to break bread together with our listeners. We look forward to meeting each and every one of you in Santa Barbara. Further information can be found at kpfk.org.
Breaking bread with my brother, breaking bread with my sister, breaking bread. Breaking bread with my cousin, breaking bread with my brother.